live. Hey, how are you?
Good, and you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing awesome. It's currently 6 o'clock here, the East Coast. We're in Montreal, and I'm with Melanie Candide. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Melanie. I'm a final year at political science and international development, and I'm currently in Montreal.
Awesome. Yeah, though that was my bad. I was reading the name for the podcast, which we actually just came up with today. The name of the podcast is going to be Candid. Welcome everyone to the Candid Podcast with Catalyst. And yeah, so you wrote an article on the whole climate change adaptability and what we're going to do in the future about dealing with climate change, or not dealing with it, but mitigating it going forward. So I thought that this was a really interesting article because according to our estimates, right, we're not getting rid of climate change anytime soon. And we only have until possibly 2050 to completely avoid the most disastrous effects of it. So just based on your research and kind of what you did for this article, is mitigating climate change, and should that be our preferred method moving forward? And is there any real way for us to like kind of go back?
Yeah, so basically we've been trying to offset our carbon emissions, and we've set up the Paris Agreement so that we'd have limits on how much emissions each country produces so that we would curb climate change. But I mean, if we see that, like, as things are going now, like, we're very not likely to be able to meet those goals. So right now, the international community is trying to, first of all, mitigate climate change, which means basically tackling the causes of climate change and trying to reduce the impacts of climate change. But in recent years, they're also looking at adaptation. So basically, it means that we're trying to implement some initiatives to reduce the negative effects that are caused by the disasters that are accelerated by climate change. And so that means helping vulnerable communities, adapting their livelihoods and also physical infrastructure so that they're less impacted by climate change. So far it's very new. And so even in, for example, I know that in my, I'm not in the environment as a major, but from what I've seen, adaptation is it's a very new area of interest. So there's not that much talk about it, but it's gaining more and more attention.
Yeah, it's gaining kind of more traction as we have to. Do you have like an example of like adaptation for some of these communities? What is adaptation in the real world? Like, what do communities need to do? What do we need to do to help them adapt climate change?
So basically, for now, the project initiatives are mostly focused on infrastructure. So for example, building new infrastructure that would better handle, for example, floods or hurricanes, etc. Okay. And also building sustainable practices in agriculture, for example, when droughts hit, then we have to we're trying to switch to drought sensitive seeds so that the crops are yielding more and more produce. Yeah, stuff, food stuff. Exactly. Yeah. So that we're able to keep up with the changes.
Okay. So I assume this is going to be in like rural areas, more like like underdeveloped, like rural areas next to floodplains or even an area like areas of high drought. So yeah, that's really interesting. And like, so us as the global North, I know that I have a vague, I don't know, I'm in history, right? So I don't know much about all of this, but I know we're kind of spearheading this movement in a lot of ways towards these institutions and stuff. But I also know that from reading your article, that indigenous sources of adaptation are pretty important as well, like indigenous sources of information for adaptation. So what does that mean? What are some indigenous sources of adaptation, and like how can we properly take those into account?
So in recent years, we've noticed that there's a lot of local knowledge and local practices that could be really useful for us to incorporate in our project or initiatives for adaptation. So for example, we've noticed that there are cases in, for example, Zimbabwe or Mexico, the local community is able to predict hydrometeorological threats. So for example, like they're able to predict that tsunamis are coming or hurricanes are coming, thanks to observations of, for example, the sky or the sea animals and plants. Yeah, and it's very interesting. And and they do that through traditional
practices.
Exactly. And so this is like super important to understand because first of all, it helps us grasp how they're already adapting. And so that would not only facilitate our efforts, but it would also serve to incorporate them more into the project so that they're more likely to collaborate with us, and they're more likely to really feel the impact of the projects.
So we're working on trying to see more from their perspective in like a lot of ways on these issues. And the meteorological, I have trouble saying that word sometimes too. it's too long, they should cut it down. But yeah,
they should dumb it down for us students.
Simple folk trying to say these big words.
Exactly.
So, so with that meteorological and the ability of local practice and reading the landscape and the, because I know in like Polynesian wayfinding, right? Like traditional Polynesian wayfinding, they read the stars and they use the stars as a map, and they read the seas to be able to, or they used to do this to be able to, I'm sure some still do, but to be able to navigate through like all the islands, and pretty much the Pacific would become a large land mass for them in a lot of ways where they could read it pretty accurately. But what, do you have any kind of insight into what the impact of climate change would be on these practices? Like, so if we impact the way of the currents, right? Like the ocean currents in a lot of ways by heating the oceans and then more cold water. And then like, I'm not entirely sure how ocean currents work, but I'm fairly certain that adding more water would to like from the melting of the ice caps and just more like global warming would change the current in some way. And that would kind of render that Polynesian source of information really difficult to adapt to. So how do we, I guess my question is, how do we like balance that? Like, how do we balance indigenous sources of information? Like, do you have any insight to that basically? I think.
Well, what I've seen through my research is that locals are already able to adapt to some degree already to those changes. So for example, fishermen that are like every day outside in the sea, they're able to
they're kind of like used to it, they're used to
exactly that. Okay. They're already adapting themselves to those changes. So I'm not an expert in this, I have very limited information on this, but from what I've understood, they're adapting every day, and yes, it's limited because it's it's not based on science. It's really based on like firsthand like observations.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. But we've seen that it can be like in the case of, for example, hurricane warnings, fishermen or locals observations have been almost as accurate as like official warnings. And so, and in addition to that, they not only adapt their local language, but they also adapt their practices. So even without our intervention, there's been some cases where communities adapt their sources of income, like sources, like means of sustenance. Yeah. So for example, instead of just doing fishing, they also delve in agriculture or cattle farming, or they complement fishing with tourism. So going on boat tours and stuff like that. So that's why I think it's very important to focus on what they're already doing so that we can build on that and support them instead of just coming there and be like, do this, do that. And we think we know, we think we know better, but
we
gotta do that.
Like, it's kind of like we, like as, we take like more of a broad approach when we go there. Yeah, and we're like, this is what you should do. But then these like indigenous sources of information are more like, no, this is what we've been doing that works. And so that actually leads really well into like the next question of like and our next conversation point of how we balance those local practices with our things of adaptation, our, let's take Canada for an example, Canada's prerogative for adaptation. I don't know. What do you think we should be doing more of?
You mean like in Canada?
No, just like the global north. Like, what do you think we should be doing more of to get those indigenous sources of information? Like to take those into account. Like, do we have to balance the local practices with our adaptation? Should we take a more? Should we take a more like solely local practice approach, or like what is that split like?
Well, something that's been more and more prevalent in international development in general is really making sure that you understand the situation on the ground. So that means being in constant communication with the locals, with the NGOs, and really making sure that you're operating within their context. Because in the past, we've tended to have a like one size fits all projects where we try to I don't know, like school, build schools for like how many villages in Africa, dig wells and et cetera. But we don't really take into account the not only the cultural context, but also the socioeconomic conditions of those places. Mm-hmm. And so I think that to be, in order to incorporate local knowledge and but also traditions and their culture, we have to be able to operationalize our efforts within their own framework. You know, like we have to be able to navigate the complex dynamics that come into their everyday practices, their public life, their interactions with each other, because there's a lot of already in place networks that we can also utilize that is already on the ground. You know, we don't have to come here, come over there and just build everything from the ground. We can just, like in my ideal world, the projects would be, you know, like building onto what they have and just giving them the resources and the additional information and resources that they need to
power.
To like empower them. And it's not just about helping them, you know, it's about a help, like not restoring, but it's about upholding and enhancing their human dignity. And so that implies respecting them and including them more.
That's a very interesting way of framing it, like respecting their human dignity, because it kind of, it's like that old like adage, like teach a man to fish and and he'll have fish for a lifetime. But if you just give him fish, then he becomes like reliant on you. And it's really like what you said about like volunteers, like voluntourism, basically, where volunteers come there, build a school, and then leave. And it's like we've already taken away so much as wealthy countries. We've already taken away so much from these like lower income countries. And you know, the world is still getting over the effects of like colonialism and like neocolonialism and all that stuff. So yeah, that's a good way to look at it, like respecting their human dignity. And yeah, that's really true, because yeah, all those ads on like TV and stuff of like going to like Africa
Oh
and
my God, I hate that. And like they make you pay so much to like do something like volunteering
like
that is like supposedly to be free, you know, like
yeah.
it's very weird. It's pyramid schemes.
That's, yeah, it kind of is a pyramid scheme. And to get an old white guy to like come in the commercial and be like, only $1 a day. Like, you could come save these poor little children that we have
Exactly.
the camera crew on. No,
And
that's
only $2,000 per week.
at only $2,000 a month. Or, so yeah, that's ridiculous. But you also talk about in your article how some of these adaptations kind of almost they don't work out as well as we expect. And one of those happened in Bangladesh. So my next question for you is, can we look to Bangladesh kind of like as a warning or a chance to gain some insight into how to properly adapt to climate change for especially like poorer communities?
So I definitely think that we should do both, that we should take Bangladesh as a warning, but also take from our mistakes and create them into lessons. Because to me, Bangladesh face, it really reflects how disconnected projects can be from the actual needs of the people, of the community we're trying to help. Because it shows that we tend to just, you know, like throw money and resources at a problem and pray that it goes well. Whereas what we need to understand the nuances and the subtleties that come into, like I was saying before, you know, the context. But to me, context is everything. And like you really got to be you like in initiatives like this, we need to understand that those countries operate within different cultural norms, different institutions, and they have different capacities in place. And it's like, for example, a project may work very well in Canada, but it might not work at all in India, which may sound so obvious, but I feel like projects oftentimes forget about this, that we got to take into account that those countries work very differently at local and the regional and the national levels than our countries or even neighboring countries, you know. And so that's why as I was saying, constant communication, collaboration with the communities in questions are so important, because it's by being on the ground and by really being present and being in cooperation with them, that you can understand the nuances of the networks, the different power dynamics that come in play, the hierarchies also that could either help or really be undermining the project. And so that's why it's super important to incorporate those communities within the project and within even our, I mean, you know, like a lot of projects come there and they have people in charge, like how do you say it?
Like
Like
foreign people in
strangers.
charge.
Exactly. Yeah, they have foreign people in charge, and sometimes the communities are they don't say anything and they just follow along. But like we're missing out a lot, because they could bring very important insights that into this. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to have like a white Canadian guy, for example, like me, and like leading a Bangladesh adaptation thing. Like it doesn't make any sense at all. And sometimes volunteer groups go in and they don't even like speak the language, some like in some cases of the like not every volunteer speaks the language. And that's really hard because like basically like as you're saying, we have to treat them like equals and collaborate with them. as equals. And that's so difficult if you guys do not speak the same language and you're just like, you're two 20-year-olds, but like one of you just speaks English and the other one just speaks a completely different language. Like let's just say like Latin American Spanish. And like, how are you supposed to collaborate and come up with effective solutions if you guys like, so yeah. And on the part of us like wealthier like countries, I feel like we need to take those steps then to really like talk to them in in ways as they're equals.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, like when you come into a country where you don't really know anything about, you don't know the culture, the political situation, the socioeconomic situation of those communities, you're kind of thrown into exactly. And so if you just try to apply like a simple solution in your mind, I mean, you're going to be faced with very complex dynamics that are going they're just going to prevent your project from being actually efficient, you know, and that's very important.
Yeah. And we were talking about this a bit like off camera, obviously, but the whole thing that's happening in Chile right now with some, like, that's kind of gone under our noses, where we still have like local communities not being heard and being taken advantage of in a lot of ways for mainly for like, or I don't want to say corporate gain, but a lot of it for corporate gain, but just like trying to find a climate change solution for us is costing these communities. So like adaptation costing another group, because for those that don't know, like basically in Chile right now, there's a lithium crisis, pretty much, like, because the salt flats in Chile are being mined of all their lithium, and those are needed to make like electric cars and phones and computers. And I'd say it's a pretty big problem with climate change adaptability. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that based off what you researched.
Yeah, I found this case super interesting because like it's not something that's just pertaining to Chile too. There's been also reports in Tibet in the past where because we're mining for lithium, there's contamination of fresh water and it's killing off wildlife. It's affecting local people's health and livelihood. And so this case is super interesting because, you know, lithium is something that we use in like virtually everything now. And it's going to be like, we're going to need a lot of lithium too, on top of other minerals and resources that are extremely resource intensive for our shift from our fossil fuels to more renewable resources. Like, and it to me, it really highlights the fact that when we're talking about shifting away from non-renewable resources, we have to take into account the whole supply chain of the new technologies that we're going to try to, like the new infrastructure we're going to try to put in place for that. And so this really shows that like there are like a lot of cost opportunities that come into play.
Yeah, for that. That's so true. And I don't think we take those into account as much, obviously.
Oh, not at all.
Not at all, exactly. And the amount of, and it's kind of crazy that like electric cars are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper by the year. And what does that mean for the Chilean and like Tibetan ecosystems? Because that just means that more lithium is getting mined, and like to an extent, because it's only, I think it's only like a third of all lithium is in Chile, but that's still a lot of like lithium. And yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking to see those ways, not only for like the human ecosystems of it all, but also like the animal ecosystems, because you have a lot of animals that are reliant on that kind of stuff, like on the salt flats, because it's in the Chilean desert, right? So there's like no water. Chilean desert.
Yeah.
My mind went to like Peru for a second. I was like, Is it Peru? Have I been talking about the wrong country this entire time? Man, what a great first episode of the podcast. Off on about Peru instead of, yeah, I'm just going to confuse myself, I think. Anyway, but yeah, yeah, I don't know. It's so, and like all the iPhones that come out like every year, it's crazy. I don't know about you, but I had like an iPhone 4 for like the longest time. And like, there was just, there's an insane, like all the, and all of them use lithium, every single one of them, all these lightweight phones just use lithium. And yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's pretty insane. I don't know.
Yeah. And the worst part is that honestly, like we like progress is great. Technology is great, but at the end of the day, we're still dependent on this like exploitative relationship with the developing countries. Because honestly, if we paid the same amount, like if, for example, like the minerals that we buy from the Republic of Congo or other countries like this, if we paid the same amount that it would be worth at, for example, in Canada, or telephones would cost like maybe like 10,000 or something, like throwing a number off our head, but like we really exploit their resources still, which is like, I mean, a form of neocolonialism in a way, but
Have you seen you've seen the debts, right, that like other countries have to us? It's crazy. Like they owe us so much money, but we owe like a lot of money as well. But we don't pay that any mind. So that's insane. Paying like 10 grand for my phone instead of like a grand. Jeez.
The worst part is that like, you know, those like we're so dependent on them. Like, and the end of the day, like without their resources, we would have nothing. Like it'd be so much harder to have the computer that we have. But like when you look at their situation and you compare with our situation, you really see that like there's a huge discrepancy. And there's a huge power struggle. And like they're still like, we're still trying to submit their economies to ours, you know?
Yeah. And that's not a way to go at all, because obviously now like this whole climate crisis is happening in like 100 years. I think that rounds it out to actually about half an hour. So,
nice.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Melanie, for coming on and having this great conversation with me. I really did enjoy learning about this stuff. This is like, it's pretty crazy. Like just adaptation. I have no idea about like so much of this because I'm in history, but as I've mentioned already in the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast, and I'm honored to be the first one. And and honestly, I really appreciate you being interested in my article. Like, this is something that is really important to me, and like it's a subject that's like really interesting to me. So I'm glad to be able to like share the little knowledge that I have with other people.
And as you said, like, okay, before we go, as you said, it's not talked about at all, right? In like the international development literature, like really quickly, if you can, what is up with that? Why isn't it talked about?
So like adaptation, I've only heard it in like one of my classes, like mentioned super briefly. Yeah. And I have also a friend that's in management, that she does managing for sustainability. So she talks about like sustainability and climate change or whatever. And also I've taken a bunch of other classes on the environment. And honestly, I feel like this is such a undervalued area of expertise, because like it's so new. And right now the public attention is so focused on lowering carbon emissions that we forget that climate change is already happening. You know, there's already signs that global temperatures have never been so high in the last 100 years. There's so many climate change triggered weather events that are destroying livelihood and infrastructure like all the time, and we don't I think that it's really important that right now we try to find alternatives to that, to carbon offsetting, because I mean, I know that adaptation can only go so far, you know, like if there's going to be entire islands are going to be submerged and you can't really do anything about that without curbing climate change. But at the same time, adaptation is something that we should focus on right now because it's happening right now. And if we wait till we're like, till we realize that we're not going to meet the Paris Accord goals, then that's it, you know, like it's going to be too late.
It's something to think about for sure, definitely. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, humans have never been good at long-term planning, but I guess that's a topic.
I know.
But
listen to that podcast.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that was awesome. So, yeah, I think now we'll sign off.
Hey, thanks for making it through the Candid Podcast. If you want to check out more of our stuff, you can look us up on Facebook and Instagram at Catalyst McGill. A big thanks to Melanie for coming on. You can check out her article, The Hazards of Disconnectedness and Climate Change Adaptation Discourse, on our website, catalystmcgill.com. And for our next track, we'll be going into the Myanmar military coup crisis.